Tansay, hello, and welcome. You're listening to Voices of Our People on the Windspeaker Radio Network. I'm Daniel Barker Tremblay. Today, we continue our conversation with Candace Ward from Kihiu and Cree Nation in Northern Alberta. With you being able to sit at the table in those meetings, is a part of your organization's movement towards truth and reconciliation. And when you start seeing stuff like that happen, especially within your career and in your industry, what would be like some of the advice that you would give or want to give to aspiring photographers that want to follow in similar footsteps as you? Because I remember when I graduated from State, I saw you in a video package at the State graduation, and I was like, oh my goodness, like that's awesome! Like she's doing that, because I had just got my career here in Windspeaker Radio Network, and I remember. On my way to grad, I was already a month into my job, and I had booked the day off to go to my graduation ceremony. And during that first month, I was thrown into the fire early with no experience of photography, learning from the tutelage of Bert Crowfoot. And so, thank goodness for that, because if it wasn't for that, I'd be like, I think it's just like, anything else, you just point and shoot. But, what advice would you give, not only just to myself, but other aspiring photographers that want to follow in your similar footsteps, to take photos, to capture moments that, as the old saying goes, a photo is worth a thousand words, a picture is worth a thousand words. What advice would you give?
Tell a story. Understand why and what you're putting in front of your camera. So you're there to tell a story. And like, if you're trying to, why that saying says a picture is worth a thousand words, it means you should be able to look at a picture and understand everything that's happening in that story without having to read the story. That's what that means. So you shouldn't have to read the caption. Of course, you will. Like, if you want to know exactly who that person is, like if it's not somebody famous that you already recognize, you would have to read the caption to know the name of that person. But you want to be able to look at a picture and feel that moment. So whether it's a moment of joy, pain, you want to be able to just feel it in that moment. So in sports, you want to be able to understand what happened in a game by looking at one picture. So if it's a Stanley Cup final, if you don't have somebody hoisting the cup in the picture, do you know that that was the Stanley Cup final? Probably not. So understanding, you got to understand what you're putting in front of your camera and why. It's not just the technical part of point and shoot. It's having relevant content from corner to corner of all your frames, and that it best tells the story without having to explain the story to somebody.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And now with that, with being shaped into the photographer that you're well known to be, let's talk about somebody that helped you shape you into that. One of the many people, I should say. Can you talk about Jen Pierce, a fellow photographer in the sports photography, and how that person has influenced you with helpful advice that motivated you and shaped you into the person that you're known as today?
I think that's kind of the reverse. Jen is... Jen graduated after me. Can we kind of take this question out?
Yeah,
would that be okay?
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. Okay. No worries. I just want
to. Okay, so Jen is actually, like, this is off the record. Jen would be more like I mentored her versus the other way around. Yeah. And Jen is somebody I've worked with, but she's always been like an assistant to me or a second shooter to me.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it's not been her influencing my career. It's been more me influencing her career.
So let's touch on that then. So with the mentoring portion of your career, what's that been like to take somebody under your wing and say, this is how it's done, this is, how we tell the story? Like, what's that been like?
That's been a pretty rewarding part, probably, like, for me as well. Like, I did just finish teaching. I was a contract instructor at SAIT in the same program, in the journalism program, for 3 years. And it's been amazing. Like, I love taking time to teach people like how to tell a good story through photography, how to connect with people and how to tell their stories. That part has been amazing. I've been lucky enough to have a couple of, like, I had a couple of interns or like practicum students over my time. And I think most, yeah, and all those, I still stay in touch with them. It's rewarding for me too. Like, I think, I'm not saying the way I do things is the right way all the time. That's definitely not it. But ultimately, like, it's me versus me, and I want people to understand that it's them versus them all the time. That when they're out there in the industry, they're trying to make a better picture that every day, better than the one they made the day before. So when they're out there, they're competing against themselves. They're not really competing against somebody else. So if you're at the Super Bowl shooting, you might be competing with other people and other publications, but ultimately at the end of the day, it's like, no, you're competing with yourself to get the file faster than you've gotten it out before, get the right angle, the right storytelling picture, like that part you're doing. So helping other people is not like giving away the secrets. Like, it's not like giving away any like massive secret. I don't mind, for me, it's like, I don't mind helping to teach somebody to drive, but I'm not going to give them the keys to my car. So like, I will help people in any way that I can, but I'm also not going to give you my client list. Like, you can go buy your own car.
I know that feeling all too well. I know that feeling all too well because, you know, in this industry, you know, we had just got a new news guy that just started, and he was a buddy I went to school with. And once he started, he was nervous at first, but you could tell that he was, you know, easing himself into it, but always asking questions. And I know that humbling feeling all too well to help somebody, you know, to be a better person for the better and not to be better than that person. And, you know, you also can learn from a lot from the people you teach as well. They can also teach you a thing or two. And of course, with that being said, I have to ask, with some advice that you've gotten over the years, you know, as one friend has once told you, a friend of yours told you one time that you don't have to be anybody's definition of an Indigenous person. You just are one. And when you hear that quote that's been repeated to you, and then you've often said, what would you hope for that people could take away from that? Because I feel like a lot of times, you know, especially myself when starting in this career, especially with Windspeaker, I have found my identity within being a Métis person, Region 1. Is that what that quote would mean in a sense, is to just remember who you are and where you come from?
I think so, but it's also just don't feel that like outside pressure from outside of our community. I think that's the more important part, is that it's not necessarily coming from within our community. It's from the outside of our community. Is those, that kind of pressure of them like having an expectation of your knowledge of your culture, your connection to your community, like all that kind of stuff. Like, if it's like, oh, well, you didn't live in your community growing up, that means you're not really Indigenous. It's like, no, I am. I still am. Like, that's just because that's what you think should Indigenous people should be like. That doesn't mean what it is. So that's just kind of how I took it. Is when I was told that, it's just like, it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter if you're, you know, going to ceremony regularly, if you're, you know, you participate in powwow, you this and that, like all those kind of things. It doesn't matter what their definition is. It's just, you just are Indigenous. No matter how close to your culture, your family, whatever, it doesn't matter. You just are. So that was a big thing for me. It was just like, it doesn't matter what other people's definition of Indigenous is. Like, it's in my blood. It just is. I just am.
And you had touched earlier in the interview that you had worked, like you were at the table with your organization to talk about organizing Indigenous events and such. Now, the Indigenous celebration and culture, is there a difference between the Indigeneity from the States to compared to, Indigeneity, here in Canada? What's the differences, or what are some of the similarities that you've seen with going into some of the Indigeneity communities within the stateside?
I haven't actually been in yet, so that would be too hard for me to answer.
No worries. But and then I have to ask though, with you being in your industry, have you run into many Indigenous photographers alongside yourself and said, hey, it's great to see that? Or would you want to see more Indigenous people, men, women, or two-spirited, to participate and become photographers to help tell stories, because we are known for being storytellers?
This is a great question. I want to see more. I want to see more. And if there was any possible way that I could help get more people out there, get gear into the hands of our people, that would be a dream come true. In my industry, I don't know, and I would love to be corrected, I don't really know any Indigenous women photographers who are shooting high-level sports consistently like myself. I've just started talking to somebody who has an internship at a major sports team, but hasn't been as rooted in the major league type stuff that I've been in for as long as I've been in. And it is lonely, and it is difficult to navigate, because people don't get it. And you're trying to carve a path and get people to understand representation. And it seems like people don't really care. They don't understand how important it is to our youth or our women in our communities too, to say hey, you don't have to be a professional athlete. You don't have to be a coach to be able to work or be in sport. Mm. You can find a way to be in sports in other capacities, and photography is one of them, or videography, content creation, storytelling, all that kind of stuff. You can do that, but they don't have anyone. I don't have anyone that I can look up to, or have had anyone that I can look up to as an example. I've had to do it alone and be on this path alone, and it is difficult. It is extremely difficult. And I want women and people of our community to understand this is a path you can take. Mm. And I hope that I can find a way to make it easier for them to be able to take this path. I think it's getting slightly easier than when I started, for sure. But it's a grind, and it's hard, and it's doors do not open as easily as you think. It's like being an athlete. Mm-hmm. Stuff's not just handed to you. You got to work pretty hard to get anywhere in this career. So I would really like to see, some more Indigenous photographers, especially in the field of sports, for sure.
That was Candace Ward from Kahuin Cree Nation in Northern Alberta. You're listening to Voices of Our People on the Windspeaker Radio Network. I'm Daniel Barker Tremblay. Next, we continue our conversation with Joyce Healy from Kainai First Nation in Southern Alberta. What was your experience attending Lethbridge College?
I started off at Lethbridge College, and I think that was at the beginning of, they were just starting to put together the University of Lethbridge. That's how far back. And, it was at that time that I was also starting to work at Matthew Halton Community School. And when I started there, it was the Miksumukitapiks, the elders from Pikani, because that was one of their in Pincher Creek, that was adjacent to the Pagan Reserve. It was Josephine and Joe Crowshoe, the old people that came, and Yellow Horns. They came in and basically gave me the instructions, and the people that I was working with there, that we needed to begin to teach the language and some courses on our people. So that was how I got started. And I never really attended Lethbridge College as a student. I went on to university. I went to the University of Alberta. My experience there was I felt that most of the time they should have been paying us, because we were constantly questioning, not in all the subjects, but if you were taking political science, history, philosophy, you know, those courses. And so it was really a frustrating, I enjoyed it. It was exciting. It was something that it was knowledge, but it was also frustrating because it was just limited, you know, in terms of, again, our history, our worldviews being taught. And so that was my experience with what I call now colonial academics. The assimilation process, it was frustrating. So for me now to go back and to be able to be a sessional instructor at the University of Lethbridge, at one time, no longer, I just go in, and also at Lethbridge College, a sessional instructor. I was also an instructor at Blackfeet Community College in Browning, Montana. I worked at the Cutswood Blackfoot Immersion School. And what are some of the others? And yeah, so I taught for these colleges. And the main focus being is I teach from our perspective, but I parallel those teachings so that my students will be able to understand both worldviews and essentially the collisions and sometimes where it can be good. So that's my experience with education.
Now, Joyce, I was going to say, I have to ask, is so with some of the experiences or most of the experiences that you've experienced in life, what was the one thing that stood out to you, if you can recall, that basically shouted to you, I want to be, you know, an instructor and, of course, an Indigenous relations consultant, especially within places like, you know, the Lethbridge College and other universities?
I can't say that there's anything that, you know, like an epiphany or a moment. It was ingrained in me. And I think that once I really understood the injustices and really that was what I felt was my motivation to continue finding those answers and what role can I play. But I think the most important part of it was just that my elders, my teachers, they didn't give me all this information and this, you know, the what I call the light just for myself. It was there to share. So I think that it's just been kind of ongoing. I can't really think of a time or a moment. I can think of times or moments when it really hit on me that, okay, now I get it. And it was only because I was able to see the parallel. Am I making sense?
That makes perfect sense. And, you know, your work that, you know, that you've done also involves educating people about the culture and the language, as you've touched on, of Blackfoot. Now, how important is it, from your perspective, is the work of revitalization, you know, of the language, the culture, and the teachings as well?
It's extremely important, especially on a legal level now, because what language is, language articulates the belief system, the philosophy, the concepts, the principles of a people. That's where that worldview comes from, and it articulates that. So, for example, that one word, everything is alive. It could be further translated into energy, which is physics, the study of energy. And so language is important. And you think in that world, that Blackfoot world. And as claiming as First Nations people, which we are, is that we had land, the Blackfoot Confederacy, the traditional territories. It's not traditional. It's still our territories. It still hasn't been determined. You know, the treaties still haven't been. We're just finally getting a little bit of the plow and the cow. That we have a land base, the territory, and the Sagaitatabishkaku, you know, that was basically most of Alberta and into Saskatchewan, the Sandhills, down into parts of the Dakota and into Montana. That's a big spread. And we had people. We had clans. And that's why we had the three main tribes. So Siksika, all their clans spread out, taking care of the northern territories, the boundaries. The Kena, the middle part. Siksika, you know, the northern. And then Bikani, the going into what's now the States. It was big, like I said, a big spread. And it was populated. So we had people. And we had our institutions of, we had our warriors, the brave dogs, we had our military, camp, the territory, we had linguistics, individuals that were sent to live with different tribes so they could learn the language, to allow for the trade and communication. And we had, of course, the military to protect, and we had the resources, the buffalo. So that's a big area, and the language that kept it all together. So language is extremely important.
And now I have to ask you, you know, throughout your time as an instructor and an Indigenous relations consultant, what are some stories from your experiences as within those titles, of course, that, you know, you've had with student interactions that just made you smile from ear to ear?
There's several, but I would like to share with you is it, there were very significant moments, and it did make me, I wouldn't say in that kind of an emotional, but when I had a student that came, and not there's not just been one, there's, you know, most of them, when they come to me at the end of a session or a workshop or whatever it is, and they come to me and they either say, oh, thanks, Donkey or Joyce, and break down and cry to say, thank you for helping me understand that it's not my fault. Because of the guilt that we've had to, that we've carried through these, I didn't really talk about the residential. Mm. but the impact that it had on us. So that's the other aspect, is the language is also going to heal us. Because that's who and that's how we begin to understand our own identity. That's how important this language business is.
And
it's a healing. It makes you heal, because then you know who I am.
Mm.
Where am I going? Why am I here? You understand the history. And that gives you the direction as to where are you going to go with all of this now? And so the revitalization of the language is paramount. And most importantly, not in the colonial academics, paradigms, and methodologies. That is one of the biggest obstacles that our academics and our educators face. Even though there are mandates in the Truth and Reconciliation and efforts, but the experiences that I've had insofar, because we're being asked to go and work with major education institutions, corporations, name it. But sometimes it's just it looks good on paper, but when they get you in there, they got the monies to do it. And they say, oh yes, we need to have it done like this, and that's the way, the indigenization. But really, that's not always the case. And I think that's one of the biggest obstacles. So getting back to what makes a person shine is when you know and smile that you got it and you know where you're going with that newfound information and knowledge that helps you and makes you grow as a human being, and knowing that, okay, now I understand what I need to do to continue that, bringing that light and that love into the world.
That was Elder Joyce Healy from Kainai First Nation in Southern Alberta on Voices of Our People. I'd like to thank today's special guests for joining us, Candace Ward and Joyce Healy. Join us next Thursday for more Voices of Our People on the Windspeaker Radio Network.